is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today is a musician, a producer, a fellow who does extensive work with digital manipulation of sights and sounds. He's become quite interested in a subject that's fascinated him since his youth, namely video fakery. He presented a discussion of this at the Madison Conference at my invitation. He has put together a critique of the videos taken on 9/11 from a helicopter entitled Chopper 5 Composite. It's a great pleasure to welcome him on to the Dynamic Duo, Ace Baker. Ace, welcome.
Hi, Jim. Great to be here.
It's just terrific. Just terrific, Ace. There's so much for us to discuss, and I'm so pleased that you have put together a web page for our reference. I would just mention a couple of things for our listeners. Namely, if you go on to 911scholars.org, you'll find new evidence related to these issues of video fakery, in particular a study that we will be discussing by and by entitled Flight 175 Impossible Speed. Also, if you scroll down further, you'll find in the new studies category what is now a 8-part series from September, Clues, and a 4-part series from Genghis, all of which purport to give evidence of video fakery. Those claims, however, have not gone uncontested, and in the process of our conversation today, we'll talk about, among others, the views of a fellow by the name of Anthony Lawson, who is distinguished for work he has done in relation to film in the past, where he's won numerous awards, and he's also produced a short piece that's quite brilliant on Building 7. You can find on YouTube or Google Video entitled This is an Orange, and did the voiceover on another piece, maybe actually more than that, entitled 9/11 Towers of Dust. I want to say I think these two pieces are really extremely good. So I will mention how Anthony Lawson, whom I hold in high esteem, has considerable reservations about the whole idea of video fakery on 9/11. Ace Baker, whom I also hold in high esteem, is my guest today. And I think we might start almost anywhere, Ace, but should we go to your webpage for openers?
Well, let's do that. People can go to acebaker.com, acebaker.com. And on my homepage, when that loads, you'll see there's a music video right in the middle of the homepage. And just to the right of that, there's a blue asterisk. And if you just click on that blue asterisk, it'll bring up another page that has some stuff for today.
Oh, terrific. And I see you're actually starting right off with this issue about the flight of the plane. I think that's such a terrific issue, Ace. I'm very pleased that that's where we're starting. Just for the sake of those who may not have played the brief video clip that you can find on 911scholars.org, what we have are multiple proofs or about the speed at which the plane is flying in relation to how it's depicted in the video. MIT estimates 503 miles an hour, British Royal Air Force 575 miles an hour, Federal Aviation Administration 586, the National Institute of Standards and Technology 546, FEMA 590. I added those and divided by 5, and we get an average of 560 miles an hour for the plane depicted in the video. Now, what's wrong with that, Ace?
Well, I don't think commercial passenger jets can fly that fast that low.
That happens to be the opinion of Joseph Keith, who's an aerospace engineer and who designed the shaker system for Boeing. According to Joseph Keith, whose views are reported in this video, the plane at the 700 to 1,000 feet altitude, which would be the case here, begins to shake apart at 220 miles an hour and would max out at 330 miles an hour. So I think there's a real issue here. Go ahead, Ace.
Well, yeah, and when, so this guy Jeff Hill called up Joseph Keith and was talking to him about that, and, when I heard that phone conversation, I got a hold of Joe Keith myself, and went down a couple of weeks ago to his home in Tustin, and we had a nice little visit for a couple of hours. He's a delightful man, and said exactly those same things.
Oh, fantastic. That's fantastic. I'm really pleased you did that, Ace. That's excellent. That's simply wonderful. Tell us a little more about the conversation. He simply reaffirmed these points that I was summarizing.
Yeah, I mean, I asked him, you know, what is the shaker system? What, you know, what's that all about? And apparently, they had, you know, Boeing, of course, has made many, many different kinds of airplanes, and they, and pretty much any object, including an airplane, has these natural resonant frequencies. And there are going to be situations where the object starts vibrating and vibrating violently. There's a famous example of the Tacoma Narrows Bridge, which began oscillating at its resonant frequency and just ripped itself apart and destroyed itself. And Joe Keith told me they had a number of airplanes that they were testing that they would go up and fly, and they just simply fell apart in the middle of the sky when they started going a particular speed.
They must have lost a few test pilots that way.
And so they actually build just a giant machine that they can put these airplanes on and physically shake them to see what's going to happen. But I mean, the point really is that first, there's just too much air. The air down near sea level is just too dense. And if jet engines try to go over a particular speed, they're trying to suck more air molecules through them than they physically can do, and it starts actually acting like a brake instead of like, you know, a gas pedal, quote unquote. And there's just going to be a limit to how fast you can move this object through that thick of air. And then, of course, even if you could move it that fast, it would begin to vibrate and shake apart.
Now, I find all this quite persuasive, but there are others who have questions about it. And, of course, I mean, obviously any argument like this is conditional upon those actually being the proper estimates of the speed from these sources, but we have five that look impeccable. I mean, the mathematics is elementary to add them up and divide to get an average of 560. But, of course, if those figures were wrong of the estimates from MIT, the Royal Air Force, and so forth, obviously that would affect the argument. So that's one condition.
And well, but they'd have to be really, really wrong.
Oh, I think.
And I came up when I did my Chopper 5 study, I came up with 537 miles an hour. From that one, so that's in real good agreement with all of these other estimates that they came up with. This basically the same way, by looking at the video, estimating the distances, and seeing how far the thing goes over a period of time.
Oh, I agree with you, Ace. It wasn't that I was disputing the figures or doubt the sources, but just that from a logical point of view, of course, if there were something wrong with the sources,
right,
that would obviously jeopardize. But I agree with you. I mean, they'd have to be off by 100%. You'd have to be talking about figures that are actually less than half of those that are being attributed here, and I think your independent estimate is an excellent addition. I had a fellow named Phil Jahan, who's done a lot of work with Dave Von Kleist on the show just a couple days ago, and I'll tell you what his response was when we return. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo, with my special guest, Ace Baker. Stand by. We'll be right back. Today, my special guest is a musician with extensive background in digital processing, especially audio, but also of late video, where he's been devoting himself to the study of the possibility of video fakery on 9/11. Ace, it's a real pleasure to have you here. As I mentioned, I had Phil Jahan on the show just a couple of days ago when we were discussing this proof, this argument that the planes couldn't have traveled that fast based upon the reports of Joseph Keith. And he was responding by suggesting, well, possibly this was some kind of souped-up plane that maybe he showed me videos from the Australian Air Force where they'd taken a 757 and it had been equipped with especially powerful engines and could perform feats of 400 miles an hour at ground and virtually vertical ascent. Now, that's, of course, not a 767. 57, but 757, that was kind of souped up, so he was implying the possibility of preserving video authenticity by maintaining that perhaps the plane was a special plane. He also made this argument, which is that the plane had these features, which Dave von Kleist has especially emphasized, of some kind of anomaly on the bottom that's been colloquially referred to as the pod. And also, of course, there's this kind of flash interaction between the plane and the building. And as reliable a source as George Nelson, retired Colonel, U.S. Air Force, has observed that the plane has these non-standard features. George, by the way, was featured in the redo of Dave von Kleist's original film In Plain Sight, called the 9/11 Ripple Effect, saying that if these actually were on a commercial airliner, they'd have to have special certification. Since they don't, he infers this can't be the planes are supposed to be. Based on my own research, I have been inclined to think this kind of pod-like configuration may be a flight management system that Boeing has developed. And I understand, though I'm trying to recall my source exactly on this, that when Boeing was contacted about it, they said, yes, they knew what it was, but they couldn't discuss it on national security grounds, which tends to reinforce my belief that if it is a flight management system that enables the control of the aircraft to be taken over from the pilots or hijackers or whomever, and controlled from the ground or from some other source. Do you want to comment on either of those kinds of arguments that Phil Jahan was offering?
Sure. I think there might be other problems with trying to think that there's any kind of plane or indeed any kind of any flying object going at those towers for a few reasons, one of which is wake vortex. If anybody out there wants to go to acebaker.com, go to the homepage, find that blue asterisk, click on that, and get to this page. We can scroll down this page, maybe halfway, go past these graphs, and
yeah.
Look for a really blue and red picture, and it says wake vortex there.
Yes, I'm looking at it.
And if you click that picture, you can get a larger version of it. We see a little crop duster airplane, and somebody's put a bunch of smoke, red smoke, in the air so that you can see the pattern of the air. And we see this tornado-like disturbance in the air behind it. And the picture's cropped off, but there would actually be another similar one on the coming from the other wing, turning the other direction. And then there's you can see another photograph below there of a jet flying above the clouds, and you can see back behind in the path of that jet, you see the clouds are curling over.
Oh, yeah, very nice.
This wake vortex is caused for pretty much the same reason as a tornado. You have extremely high pressure underneath the airplane wing, extremely low pressure above the airplane wing, and just behind on the tip of that wing, those two pressures collide with each other and bend over, and so you get a rotating air mass around a low pressure, and it becomes stable because it's circulating, so it has centrifugal force, which tends to push the high pressure outwards, but then there's low pressure in the middle, which tends to cause that high pressure to be attracted in towards the center. So those two competing forces are working opposite directions and work to keep that tornado-like effect stable and twisting. Wake vortex is very persistent and can continue for a couple of minutes behind any fixed-wing aircraft, which is why that even at the busiest airports, they only land planes on a given landing strip, once every 5 minutes or so. And then there have been a number of bad accidents that have been caused by planes trying to land in the wake of other planes.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, one of his arguments, of course, was that because it had these odd features that it didn't look like a commercial carrier, and that was a dumb thing to do if they were faking the videos. And I might agree that it could have been a dumb thing to do. I asked him if he had had any military experience, because there's always somebody who doesn't get the word. And I don't presume that these were a group of rocket scientists who were working on this project, though I suppose they had to have some fairly smart people at some point in time. But I don't see how, you know, doing something dumb, and I offered several illustrations from the history of JFK, such as giving, you know, planting a weapon on Lee Oswald that couldn't have fired the bullets that killed the president, because the weapon was medium to low velocity and the bullets were supposed to be high velocity. So dumb things do happen. But here you're contrasting a dumb thing with an impossibility, as I understand it.
That's right.
You know, so I mean, if the old Sherlock Holmes adage has it, when you've eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. I mean, it may well be true that they did some dumb things here.
You know, or had to change plans, for whatever reason. So, but to continue my thought about Wake Vortex, and then I'll piggyback onto the dumb things point. But scrolling down a little bit further, we see a still that I took from the Now Day video, the first hit explosion. We see the North Tower.
Where's the vortex? I like it.
And this is about 3 to 4 seconds after a 767 supposedly went right through that very airspace.
This is quite brilliant, Ace. I like it. I like it. I like it. That's fascinating.
And you can do the same thing with the South Tower hit. We have multiple angles on that, and there's just no evidence that any sort of aircraft went through that.
This is so excellent. I mean, it's a perfect example of scientific reasoning, where you find that, you know, laws of aerodynamics that simply aren't satisfied by the evidence presented. I think that's absolutely wonderful. I think that's a splendid argument.
So, and then now on, you know, which model of plane, I have a hunch or a suspicion that they might
hold this thought, Ace. We'll be right back. This is Jim Fetzer, your host, with my special guest, Ace Baker. You're listening to the Dynamic Duo. Don't go away. My special guest today, Ace Baker, is a musician and a composer and an expert on digital processing. He's just offered a completely brilliant argument about the absence of vortex effects in the videos, where they ought to be present if these were bona fide aircraft. I got to say, Ace, I mean, if there was ever the straw that broke the camel's back, I think you've just offered it. And I find that quite ironic in relation to an observation made by Phil Jahan on an earlier show, where he was talking about how, in hurricanes you have these odd effects. I'm talking about the relative strength of the towers, of, you know, a point that Morgan Reynolds has made so often, being made of steel and concrete and a plane being made of aluminum. And he was pointing out how in a tornado a piece of straw can be impaled into a tree. And as I believe my wife was pointing out to me, well, then shouldn't the plane be sticking out from the building like the straw from the tree? And that's a brilliant reply, too, you know. I mean, this is really wonderful stuff. I think you've actually shattered this whole illusion, Ace. I think this is completely brilliant. It reminds me of the argument I got from an aeronautical engineer that how the plane at the Pentagon can't possibly have just skimmed the ground, as the government maintains, because of that pocket of compressed gas, which, of course, is air under the fuselage, and that at full throttle, even a little Cessna couldn't get closer than 15 feet to the ground, or about a wing's length, and similarly for a 757, couldn't get closer than 60 feet to the ground, or about a wing's length. So there you have a nice rule of thumb, when it's going at such a high speed, in that case 500 miles an hour. But I just got to compliment you. I mean, I am enormously impressed. This is a completely perfect argument.
Well, thank you. You know, and yet, you know, we have these videos that show these planes, coming in. So that's very interesting to try to figure out how they might have gotten planes into these videos.
Well, you see how complimentary these arguments are. Of course, I mean, here you got The Joseph Keith pointing out that it's not even physically possible for the planes to fly at these speeds at this altitude without shaking apart. Here you got so that it's impossible in the first place to have this phenomenon. Then you're talking about effects that would be necessary effects if there were planes at virtually any speed. I mean, that little crop duster is going a whole lot less than 560 miles an hour. So, you know, this is really wonderful, wonderful stuff.
Right, and the amount of wake vortex is directly related to the amount of lift that's going on, and you know we're talking about a large fixed wing aircraft that's going to require a lot of lift, and you can see a very similar aircraft in that one picture, and the clouds behind are considerably far into the background and still just curling around like tornadoes.
Of course, Morgan's offered several arguments about how even if the maximum, the velocity, what they call technically velocity not exceeded at 35,000 miles an hour, might be 593 mph, so that it's the cruising speed of a 767 turns out to be 563. When you get to 700 to 1,000 feet, the increase in the density of the air is on the order of 134 times greater.
Right, he sent me those notes, and that's what I put, and that the amount of thrust is directly proportional to the amount of drag, and if there's going to be 134 times as much drag, you'd need 134 times as much thrust, and I don't know what percentage of the total power capability is used when a jet is cruising at 500 plus miles an hour up at 35,000 feet, but I dare say it would not be able to increase that by 135 fold.
No, I think
under any conditions.
I think that's another impeccable argument. I mean, here you got a guy who's very used to dealing with numbers and mathematics, and applying himself to this problem. And for somebody like Morgan Reynolds, it's effortless to derive these calculations. And yet others, who are less competent, less sophisticated mathematically, they want to question the fact that he's an economist. It's like challenging David Ray Griffin. I mean, he's a scholar. When he's applying himself to doing research on 9/11, he does a thorough job. Look at his books. They're meticulous. They're painstaking. They're copiously documented. I mean, those kinds of arguments against a scholar like David Ray Griffin, who's now published not only five books on 9/11, but over 30 books in his career, or Morgan Reynolds, who's published six books, but whose background is just full of mathematics. I mean, there's just a misconception here about relative competence for pursuing these issues. And then you get somebody like Judy Wood, who, has all the degrees in all the right fields, and the argument is made, say, that just to pick a hypothetical example, that a physicist would be better qualified than somebody with degrees in structural engineering, engineering mechanics or materials engineering science. I mean, this is quite ridiculous. Here you got somebody who has degrees in the fields directly relevant versus a person who's basically got a general competence in relation to physics. I just don't get it. I mean, it's like the research community has blinders on, doesn't want to pay attention, doesn't understand the nature of competence, of expertise in relation to different fields.
Well, I mean, that's an interesting subject too. In a lot of cases, the people who should be doing this research just aren't. That sort of vacuum of attention is, what has spawned a lot of the independent research that has gone on. And I think that, the explanation for that is that, a lot of people are just simply afraid. I firmly believe that anyone who dares to look at the evidence has got to come to the conclusion that 9/11 was an inside job. There just really isn't any dispute. But I think that a lot of people, and I don't want to drag my brother-in-law into this. I will not mention him by name, but my brother-in-law is an architect, and of 30 years in the field, very successful, and he simply cannot discuss 9/11 with me. We had a few attempted conversations, but he is just extremely upset and fearful at the whole subject, and I think that he just fears what would happen if the truth were to come out.
Well, you can live free or be a serf forever. There's no doubt Bush and Cheney want to turn us into a population of slaves. I have absolutely no doubt about it, and that they're going to move to do it. And if you have the intellectual integrity and the moral courage to confront the truth, then you can understand the nature of the threat that they represent, which is grotesque and such a distortion and perversion of American values. I cannot understand why anyone in Congress or out would provide them the least degree of support. So I'm completely dumbfounded at the conduct of the Congress in giving, you know, blank checks to people like this who are such a disgrace to the American principles and values.
That's right. You know.
Let me ask you this question, Ace. You know, an argument that's been increasingly weighing upon me is the gross one that Morgan makes about the impression, the cutouts. Judy refers to them as cookie cutter cutouts in the north and the south tower where the planes are supposed to have entered. Morgan makes a point, for example, that you have nothing crumpled, nothing broken off, no wreckage below the impact zone, nothing in the gashes, that these have to be the cleanest crash sites in aviation history, among other anomalies. And Judy, of course, showed, photographs of this to one of her colleagues in the Department of Engineering Mechanics, who said, immediately looking at it, said, something is wrong. Something is terribly wrong, because the planes wouldn't make those kinds of cutouts. We'll be right back to this point with my special guest, Ace Baker. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Today, my special guest is Ace Baker, who is a musician, composer, and expert in digital processing, and in my judgment, one of the world's leading experts on film fakery. I got to say, Ace, you've really blown me away. This is such a brilliant argument about the wing vortex. I'm tremendously impressed. It's been my feeling for a long time that there had to be some kind of gross arguments that would help to settle this business about video fakery. And between Joseph Keith and your argument on wing vortex, I think we have found two of the most weighty arguments possible.
Yeah, I agree, both from the standpoint of, what ought to be there that isn't, and then when you just look at the physical evidence that is there, and then also when you look at these videos that just have some problems in them that just can't be explained any other way other than being video composites.
Just to comment on how some of the arguments can be nickel-dimed, Morgan has repeatedly made the point, which goes back to Valerie Grable and others, about how the planes melt into the building. And Phil Jahan was suggesting, well, maybe they fiddled with the bolts on the exterior support columns, and maybe there were some explosive charges that were perfectly timed so that the plane would actually seem to melt into the building. But the plane literally seems to melt into the building. And while in the past I have been uncertain what to think about that, the more I have pondered it, the more obvious it becomes that is not a physically possible phenomenon. And when Judy shows, these like cookie-cutter cutouts to a fellow mechanical engineer, and he observes that something is terribly wrong, she's right. It's just that most of us don't have that sufficient background and expertise to be able to just look and make that determination that her colleague made just by looking at it. A minor aside, by the way, Judy talks about the Roadrunner, and cookie-cutter cutouts. Actually, the figure she's dealing with is Foghorn Leghorn, as I imagine she knows already, though some, I think, involve the Roadrunner, others Foghorn Leghorn. In any case, the point seems to be impeccable, namely, real planes wouldn't impact this way with real buildings.
No, I don't think so. We have videos of real plane crashes, and they're chaotic. And I've looked at some frames in the Evan Fairbanks video and others. And when you look at the plane halfway in from some of these side angles, you see a perfectly straight line of disappearance. So even if you could think that a plane could completely enter the building that way, because it's so chaotic, and we really don't find straight lines in chaos.
Talking chaotic in the technical sense of how minor differences in initial conditions can make a huge difference in the outcome. This is
right.
In terms of the mathematical theory, chaos theory. Absolutely, that's impeccable. It's like the claims that, the plane coming to the building at the Pentagon, one of the wingtips hit the ground, or it hit these lampposts. Well, if the plane had hit the lamppost or its wingtip had hit the ground, it would have spun around, it would have lost its trajectory, you would have had a completely different phenomenon. There would have been wreckage littered all over the Pentagon lawn. I mean, these kinds of claims are just so ridiculous. It makes me heartsick that anyone takes them seriously.
Well, it's I guess, testimony to the psychological aspect of the whole operation. You know, it's all the way around, it's tough stuff for people to believe because they don't want to, and that's, you know, gets into cognitive dissonance and then that whole, you know, that whole thing.
You know, Ace, they say the Force can have a powerful influence on the weak-minded.
Right.
Hey, tell us about your study here about, you know, about Chopper 5, because that appears to be next in your list.
Right. Well, real airplanes have smooth motion. That is, any changes in their speed are going to be extremely gradual. And real video cameras snap frames at an extremely precise rate, 29.97 frames per second. So that means if you've got a camera taking pictures of a real airplane, a video camera, across the frame, it's going to move exactly the same distance from frame to frame to frame to frame. So any deviation or variation from that regular pattern has got to be due to noise of some sort. And so I was, you know, thinking about the whole problem of video fakery and what problems I would have if I were trying to do this. And, you know, I just wondered how they would solve the problem of camera motion. If you move the camera a little bit down, of course, that will make everything in the picture appear to go a little bit up. If you move it a little to the left, it'll make everything in the picture go a little bit to the right. So any these variations in the movement of an airplane, if there are some, could be caused by other noise factors as well. There could be atmospheric disturbances. There could be measurement errors, and there can be, you know, you're looking at lines of resolution in video, which have to essentially make decisions about where they're going to place, you know, a particular thing. Is it going to go on this line or that line? So there can be this conglomeration of errors if you try to measure the position of an airplane frame by frame by frame. But the insight that I had in thinking about this is that I discovered a method where from this total conglomeration of errors, I can subtract the errors that are caused by camera motion, because we can stabilize the video as if there was no camera motion at all, assuming we have a stationary object like a twin tower in the picture. And so what I did was I measured the motion of the airplane from frame to frame to frame, and then I stabilized the video by shifting each frame of video left, right, up, down, whatever it needed, so that the building appeared to hold perfectly still. And then measured the motion of the airplane again and compared the two. And by doing that, we've still got whatever errors were present in this conglomeration minus the camera motion errors. And so because we know that camera motion has to impart errors onto the motion of that airplane, therefore subtracting those errors out must reduce the overall amount of errors. And so in terms of a graph, I plot these on a graph, and the graph line needs to become more straight. It needs to become less jagged after we stabilize the video than it was before we stabilize the video. So I say total error minus the camera motion error has to equal less error. And I did my own control studies on this, shot video of airplanes flying and with handheld, shaking the camera around. And indeed, when I stabilize the video, the motion of the airplane becomes much more stable, much more regular.
So it isn't the case that the series of red dots has to be exactly uniform. It can have minor variation. This is an intermediate stage in arriving at your conclusions about what happened, at the real proof. Is that right?
That's right. We know just from theory that in reality, if we had a video with infinite resolution to it, the motion of the airplane would be absolutely perfectly stable. It would move exactly the same amount in every frame, from frame to frame to frame. But There's going to be measured differences simply because of measurement error, and the resolution of the video is not infinite. No matter what quality of video it is, there's going to be some limit to how accurately you can measure something. But so there's going to be this, and also there could be there could be variations in the atmosphere, reflections, and all that kind of stuff. And we'll get to the rest of this, I guess, after
the break. Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Ace Baker, discussing evidence of video fakery. Believe me, this is an historic broadcast you don't want to miss. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today, Ace Baker, is a musician and composer and an expert on digital processing, and has produced an absolutely devastating argument that by itself, in my judgment, proves conclusively that video fakery was taking place on 9/11 in relation to the videos that were being broadcast by the major networks of the impact of the planes on the Twin Towers. Ace, I got to commend you. I think this is a powerful form of vindication for Valerie Grable, Nico Haupt, even Gerald Holmgren and others who have tried to make this point over and over, but in my opinion, with arguments that are far less weighty than those that you are reviewing and producing here. So I've got to say I'm tremendously impressed and very grateful to you for pursuing this.
Well, thanks. We're all... just trying to push this thing forward and trying to learn and, standing on the shoulders of giants, as it were.
Well, I'm not going to say that, there's not going to be a raft of resistance. I imagine, for example, that some people I could name are fashioning their arguments as we speak, but
as it should be, I've never, been any, afraid of this. I've spent a considerable time going on the JREF discussion forum, which is populated by people who are completely inclined to disagree, and I throw myself in there specifically in order to test my arguments.
Well, all scientific findings are tentative and fallible and subject to being assessed and criticized and kicked around. I mean, I sought to make that point at Cooper Union when Richard Gage implied that Stephen Jones' findings about Thermate were infallible. And I said, look, the man is he's a Latter-day Saint, not a saint.
Right.
It's not that he's infallible, and if his work is not shaky, it can withstand critical scrutiny, and if it can't, then it shouldn't be the basis for going forward with a lawsuit. I mean, a lot of people out there in the activist community, you don't understand the nature of scientific research, and they have been so vicious in attacking people like you or me or Judy or Morgan for making arguments that they never understood, they didn't bother to study, they couldn't appreciate, they didn't have the background. I mean, the whole idea that this is supposed to be a research community in a broad sense is just massively contradicted by the kinds of rubbish, the kinds of attacks that are completely worthless. They even drove me off of 9/11 Blogger. I had a blog on there. I was offering an alternative to the majority opinion there. And when somebody, mostly it was explaining why I don't think Steve Jones' work is decisive. And one of the commentators, I would say, had been studying my arguments. He'd been going through it all very thoroughly. And he thought they were all so coherent and hung together so tightly that either I was completely right or I was completely wrong. And it was when I started to explain to him how he could tell with regard to the less controversial issues whether I was completely right or wrong, that I got booted off a Blogger. I mean, there's still people on there who think that I'm still hanging around and able to post and just don't have the courage to do it, as though that were my want. I mean, my God, give me an argument. I mean, that's what I am. I'm a machine made for arguing, and the idea that I would resist an opportunity if it were available to me is so quite absurd and contradictory to my character. I can't imagine anyone who knew me would make it, but of course, he being taken off a Blogger, now I see there's a whole new Steve Jones blog. I guess they must think it's wonderful to hear over and over and over the same kinds of remarks that he's made in the past. it's just stunning to me that there's a complete failure to appreciate the realities about research here and who is competent and who is not and who greater degrees of competence and why you have to challenge these things and why you can take nothing for granted. This today is so wonderful to have you on to get this new argument about the vortex. Absolutely sensational. And, of course, most of the community wasn't available to hear your arguments about Chopper 5 composite, which we're going through now. So I want you to continue with your discussion about what you discovered once you stabilized the video.
Right. So if anybody's just joining in, go to acebaker.com. And on my homepage, there's like a music video there. And just right off to the right, there's a blue asterisk. Click on that, and that'll bring up another page that's got stuff that we're going through. So yeah, to recap, the motion of a real airplane is stable on video, and if you have a handheld video where the camera's moving around, that's of course going to influence and contaminate the otherwise more perfect motion of that airplane. So by stabilizing the video, that is shifting each frame of video left or right, up or down, until you eliminate the camera motion it was recorded with, you should be able to smooth out and straighten out the motion of that airplane on video. And when I study authentic videos that I took myself of airplanes, indeed that's exactly what happens. I have very unstable airplane motion on my handheld version, but then when I stabilize it, the motion of the airplane becomes extremely stable. However, when I do it to the Chopper 5, the Fox 5 live shot of the plane going into or going behind the South Tower, the opposite happens. The motion is unstable, and then when I stabilize the video, instead of the motion of the airplane becoming more smooth as it should, it actually becomes even less stable. And that actually is just an impossibility on an authentic video. If you are to believe that could happen on an authentic video, then working the equation the other direction, what you would be telling me is that you can move a camera and have it not affect the apparent motion of something. And of course, anybody knows, you just think about it, if you're videotaping something and you move the camera around, of course that's going to affect the apparent motion of the object that's moving through the frame.
And of course, I love your work here. I think it's very impressive. It's also very sophisticated, and it's just about a degree or two so sophisticated that there are a lot of those out there who could understand the vortex argument who won't be able to understand this one, Ace.
Well, so here's one that everybody I think can understand then, and this is a brand new one too that might be real interesting. If you can scroll down about halfway on that page, just below the big explosion on the North Tower from the Now Day video,
yes,
there's a line that says, Chopper 7 and the mysterious stop and start smoke.
Yes.
So if you hit that, another page will come up, and we have a whole series of frames here that pose a mystery. So what we'll do first is just sort of look at this mystery and puzzle over what it is.
Okay.
And then hopefully I'll have an explanation for it. So the first frame, this is, by the way, this is Chopper 7 ABC, another live video. And the first frame, you can see it's toggling back and forth between frame 1 and frame 2, back and forth. Now, if you will look at the smoke that's coming off of the tower, now it's fairly subtle, but you will see that when it transitions from frame 1 to frame 2, all of the smoke goes slightly upwards and expands, which is exactly what we would expect. This smoke is coming off of the tower, and it's going up, and it's expanding. So you can see it appears to be going up and then back down. So every time it goes to frame 2, it goes up. Now scroll down to the next frame. We're toggling. Well, I guess we'll delve more into this when we come back.
Absolutely. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo, with my special guest, Ace Baker. Don't go away. You don't want to miss this. Stand by. Today, my special guest is Ace Baker. composer and musician and an expert in digital processing who's coming up with some brilliant new arguments that prove, in my opinion, as decisively as scientific reasoning can prove anything, that there was video fakery on 9/11 and that the broadcasting of this video to go a step further than ACE has gone implicates the mass media in this deception and duplicity of the American people. ACE, that doesn't mean the whole media, of course. That means some strategically placed individuals, where this appears to me to confirm the conclusion that they had video prepared in advance so that they fed in during the 17-second delay between the time of occurrence of the events and the time the actual images were broadcast. ACE, please do tell us about this smoke business, which is quite fascinating.
Right. So we're on this page, and we're looking at the Chopper 7 video, and I've got it broken up into pairs of frames. So the top frame there is toggling between 1 and 2, and we notice that the smoke coming off the tower is going up when it transitions to frame 2, and it expands. When we look at the next frame, we're toggling between frame 2 and 3. Now, you notice here the plane starting to poke in down in the lower right-hand corner. You can see it down there.
Yeah.
But if you look at the smoke, it doesn't move. It does change. The smoke becomes more degraded looking, like it's a worse quality has gone through another generation on frame 3. But the smoke doesn't move. And then we scroll down to the next pair, frame 3 to 4. Once again, the smoke is moving upwards. And then we look at the next one, toggling between 4 and 5. And once again, the smoke doesn't move. It changes quality like it got more degraded.
Now, you put 1 and 5 together, or 2 and 6 and so forth, because it seems to me in general this smoke virtually doesn't move at all. I mean, it ought to be expanding. You're talking about this plane coming forward, yet the smoke is virtually a constant.
It does move. I mean, it's that, you know, if you look at the video and step through it, it's definitely coming upwards. And remember, when we're, you know, looking at the difference between two frames, it's a 30th of a second. So it's not going to move much, but you know, I realize this might be a subtle thing to look at, but I promise you that if you will study these pairs, every time it transitions from an odd to an even frame, you'll notice that the smoke moves upwards. And every time it transitions from an even to an odd frame, the smoke does not move.
Well, that's interesting. My God.
And now, so this is a mystery. Now, I only have up to between 7 and 8. There's 20 some odd frames in this sequence. I mean, I've looked at them all, and the pattern persists. It's a mystery. Why would this be? So the first question is, well, could, you know, just to be thorough, could this be some effect in reality? Could the smoke actually be stopping and starting and starting and stopping, and of course that's ridiculous. Now we do notice, by the way, the plane moves in every frame. That's the other point. There are no duplicated frames in this. And again, I've gone through the whole sequence. The plane moves in every single frame. The motion is a bit unstable too, which is the other problem. But the smoke only moves every other frame. So, I don't think this could be anything in reality. Is there an explanation in terms of making a video composite? Could there have been something in that process that caused the plane to move every frame, but the smoke to only move every other frame? And the answer is yes. And it gets a little technical, but we're talking about the background, that is the twin towers with the smoke coming off of it, and then the airplane is an overlay that's sitting on a transparency waiting to go. But in order to work with video in the computer domain, it has to be what's called deinterlaced. Now, just hang with me, it gets a little technical, but a frame of video is made up of 480 lines from top to bottom, but those are not all shot at once. Actually, every odd-numbered line is shot in one pass, and then every even-numbered line is shot in another pass. And each one of those two passes is called a field, and they're actually shot a 60th of a second apart. And then two fields are combined together, and that's called interlacing. Those get combined together into one frame. And the regular TV video that we're used to seeing on our televisions for all these decades is interlaced video. However, to work with video in computers, you have to deinterlace it. And there are a few different methods of deinterlacing, one of which is you get rid of every other field. You discard all of the, say, odd-numbered fields and only work with the even ones. And that's actually is the most common method for deinterlacing, is you simply get rid of every other field. So what I suspect took place here is that they shot live video of these smoking towers. They deinterlaced the video, which means they had to get rid of every other field. But then they only had half as many frames as they needed to overlay the plane. So they needed to repeat. They needed to create new frames from the remaining fields that they had. So they had to repeat each frame once. There had to be two copies of each frame in order to have the right amount to fit this pre-prepared airplane overlay. And that's exactly the problem that you would run into in trying to do this. When you deinterlaced it, you would only have half the fields that you needed. And so I think that actually provides a perfectly reasonable explanation for why the smoke moves in every other frame, but the plane moves in every frame. It's the only explanation that I can think of, and it just seems to fit.
Well, I think that's fantastic. Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Ace Baker. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. Today, my special guest is Ace Baker, a musician, composer, and expert in digital processing who has been reviewing new arguments and evidence related to video fakery on 9/11, and I think with devastating effect. Ace, if we return one page, then there's something here that we surely must discuss before our time runs out, namely the nose-out sequence. Can we go to that?
Yeah, let's do it. Again, acebaker.com. Look for a little blue asterisk. For anybody just joining in, click on that. That'll bring up this page. And near the top, scroll down just a little bit, there's the Fox Chopper 5 video. I just click on that, the little icon, click on the picture, and it should take us to a YouTube version of it. I think most of us have seen this video a lot, but it bears repeating. Watch this video. There are just a number of things about it that just don't pass the smell test. You can see we start with a wide shot. The helicopter is over New Jersey, about 4 miles away from the Twin Towers, and the helicopter appears to just be holding still, rather than going to the scene of the news. This is a news helicopter. I find it very suspicious that the helicopter was just sitting there 4 miles away. I would think they would want to get at least a little closer. But in any case, they're holding pretty still, and they have this big dramatic zoom in part of the way, and then they zoom the rest of the way in, and within one frame, that is maybe two, that is about a 15th of a second at most after this final zoom in, is exactly when the plane enters the picture. That's just an extraordinary coincidence in timing that it just seems just very, very unlikely. Also, in the wide shot, now this is a YouTube version, but we have some fairly high-quality versions of this video. In the wide shot, there's just no airplane there to the right of those towers, and I think it ought to be there if it was really there. So anyway, we continue it forward, and the plane comes across the screen, appears to disappear behind the edge of the tower, which it's worth pointing out again. None of the live videos from 9/11 showed the plane hitting the tower. I repeat, none of them showed the plane hitting the tower. All of them show the plane crossing the screen and disappearing behind the edge of a tower.
Well, Ace, what about that one from downward, you know, where we see the screen at the base and we're looking upward? Isn't that one that shows it?
Right, but that was not live. You're talking about Evan Fairbanks. Now,
right.
There are a good number of videos that emerged later on.
Okay, good. Yeah, tell me more. That's very important.
So, but of the live videos, none of them showed the plane hitting the tower.
Fascinating.
And simply having a plane cross the screen and disappear behind an edge is just a very simple kind of an effect to do. You don't need to show anything breaking or twisting or anything. It's just basically overlaying a video and then creating a layer mask, which is just you describe an area of the screen where one of the video elements is going to disappear. That's just a standard tool in any of the video manipulation programs like After Effects and many, many others. So we notice that we don't actually see the plane hit the tower. We see it disappear. It sure looks to me like we see the nose of the airplane coming out the other side for about 6 or 7 frames worth of video, about a third of a second or something. And then, very quickly, we see a fade to black. Now,
of course, this is the very first installment of September Clues. And Anthony Lawson has taken strong exception to this, maintaining that, in fact, the nose out doesn't actually resemble the nose of the plane. So I wonder if you might want to address that.
Sure.
Frankly, you know, how a plane could traverse this steel and concrete structure and have a nose intact is beyond me. I mean, one of these planes is its most fragile part.
Well, no, and of course it could not and did not, and nobody thinks that it does. The quote unquote official explanation now, although there were people saying that the plane emerged through the other side shortly after, on 9/11, there were people saying that. I think they saw the same thing that we all saw and thought that they needed to say that. But now the official explanation is that this, what appears to be the nose of the plane, was some sort of dust explosion.
Dust explosion.
That's it. Because there's no exit wound. We can look at the photos and videos of that area of the tower, of which there are many.
Uh-huh.
There are no broken columns there. There's no hole for anything solid to have come out. So it has to be something like dust or debris or something. I have great difficulty understanding how an exploding anything forms the shape of a cone. I'm open to explanations. But now, so Anthony Lawson, he's written a paper, and he's got a couple of frame grabs where he has one nose of the airplane, and then he has this, you know, what I think is also the nose of the airplane from, you know, exiting the building, and they don't look the same. They don't look exactly the same. Now, you can look at the page I've made. We scroll down a little. Let's see, where is it?
Just well, I'm looking at A, B, C, D, E, F, right?
And A, B, C, D, E, and F. Now,
yeah.
So I, you know, three of those are from before it passes into the tower, and three of them are from when after it passes in the tower. No two of them look exactly the same. I'll be honest with you. I did this several months ago, and I've actually forgotten which are which. I know B is the airplane for sure.
Yeah.
I know C and F look to be quite similar in shape. And I know, I can't remember which is which, but I know one is from before and one is from after.
If I can try to figure out, you know, Anthony's argument is how can these all be, of course, if it is the nose, it obviously must be indication of video fakery because the nose couldn't have survived the transit through the building with all the steel and concrete. But I think his argument is, well, it's got to be something else because it doesn't resemble itself in different frames or it doesn't resemble what the nose should look like. Isn't it something like that, Ace?
Well, what he's saying, I mean, I read his paper, and he's saying that the nose of the airplane should look exactly the same from frame to frame, and wouldn't it have been so easy, he's alleging that I'm alleging that an unmoving picture of an airplane was inserted from frame to frame to frame, which of course they would never do. That's Monty Python, Terry Gilliam style animation, and they would never do that. They inserted a video, and I'll get to what I think is wrong.
Good.
With Lawson's point here after we come back.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Ace Baker. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Today, we're concluding my conversation with Ace Baker, who is a musician, composer, and expert on digital processing. Ace, this has been such a pleasure. I just want to reiterate that I'm quite sure that there are those who are going to take strong exception to the arguments you've been presenting, including Anthony Lawson, whose other work I have praised. Anthony sent me an email in advance of this program in which I asked him to summarize his views to make sure I wouldn't distort them. Now, he sent me this before the program. I don't know if he would revise anything he says here after the program. But he says, in relation to September Clues, it's full of innuendos, false premises, and quite frankly is a load of rubbish. My first video analysis will be posted on Google soon. I don't know anything about the Genghis series, but I believe that Ace Baker is wrong in most of the things he asserts in his Chapter 5 articles. He says there is absolutely no solid evidence to suggest that the Nade videos were faked, only innuendo. Now, I don't know what to say about that because it seems to me you've established conclusive evidence in terms of the Vortex argument that the Nade videos can't possibly be authentic. But I will let Anthony respond to that. Let me just ask you this question, Ace. Anthony says he'd very much like to debate you. I don't know if I actually caught that he wanted to do that. I've been thinking about how it could be done if it were to be done, and I think the way to do it would be, since we have 4 10-minute segments per hour, I would give each of you 1 10-minute segment, then the other, and alternate throughout. Would you be up for that?
Sure, that'd be fine.
Okay, well, I'll propose that to him. He may be listening. If he is listening, Anthony, Ace is accepting your invitation to debate, and we'll set it up, and we'll just alternate 10-minute segments, so each of you will have the uninterrupted opportunity, and I will do my best to refrain from playing any role other than as a more or less neutral moderator, though I think it's obvious, you know, where my sympathies lie. I've not made a secret about that. And we'll conduct some sort of debate on this topic. I'll seek to set it up, Ace. Meanwhile, since Anthony has been particularly distressed by this nose-out business, why don't you complete your points about it?
I'll do that. Look, just real quick, before I jump into that, if we run out of time here, I just want to plug, I have created a petition to the network news organizations for them to release broadcast quality copies of the 9/11 news videos that were shown, and of course, to the extent that there is a response to the video fakery argument, a lot of it has to do with saying, well, you're analyzing poor quality videos, YouTube videos and so forth, which is true. So the solution to that is to release broadcast quality videos, and I'm proud to say that I have support from three diverse 9/11 researchers who all support this petition despite their disagreements on everything. Meta Sozin, who's the head of the structural engineering at Purdue and who has studied 9/11 and the Pentagon and the Twin Towers and created the simulation of the aircraft hitting, has agreed to support it, as has Stephen Jones, who needs no introduction here, I suspect, as has Morgan Reynolds.
That's wonderful, and I love the petition, and I've signed it myself, and it's going to be posted on Scholars Today, Ace.
So just real quickly before I get back to Anthony Lawson, it's petitiononline.com/video911. petitiononline.com/video911 and sign that. Okay. So now,
and I don't know if you caught me, but it's also going to be posted on Scholars Today.
Great, excellent.
Okay.
And so now, in Anthony's email to you that you just read, he didn't really summarize his arguments. He makes a few arguments in his paper. One of which is that now in September Clues, it is argued that the layer mask was stationary, unmoving, and that the helicopter drifted to the left so that the mask was sitting in the wrong place, and that is what allowed the nose to come out. And what Anthony says in his paper is that that if the picture drifted away to where the layer mask was in the wrong place, yes, the exit would be revealed, but the entrance of the plane would also be messed up. And in fact, I agree with Anthony Lawson, and I disagree with September Clues. I don't think that they used a stationary mask to do that. I don't think they would have done it that way. Rather, I believe they identified where the towers were by use of what's called chroma key and luminance key, which basically can identify the difference between colors and between, you know, something that's bright or dark, and could create that mask in real time, frame by frame by frame, and they would never use just a stationary mask. So I guess I disagree with September Clues, you know, and with Lawson, but
let me make a logical point. Anthony seems to feel that he's established that this this nose thing is not right, and therefore we can discount all of September Clues. I mean,
this is just
a blunder. I mean, suppose September Clues gives a dozen arguments for video fakery. Showing one is wrong doesn't mean you've shown the other 11 to be wrong.
Well, that's right. So,
you're giving new arguments now that Anthony Lawson has never even contemplated. So, of course, we want to give him an opportunity to respond to them, including the vortex argument and the smoke, alteration argument, for example.
Right. Now, so the next thing that Lawson is saying, so I agree with Lawson there, except to say that I don't think that's how they did the mask. The second point he makes is that he thinks the nose of the airplane would look exactly the same. Those are his words, exactly the same, from one frame to the next. And because they don't look exactly the same before they hit the tower as they do coming out of the tower, therefore it's not the nose of the airplane. Well, in fact, the nose of the airplane does not look the same from frame to frame, nor should it ever. There's no reason to think that it would. The viewing angle, first of all, changes every frame. We're analyzing a VHS copy, which reduces horizontal resolution. So in some cases, the nose of that airplane might make it to the next unit of resolution, the next dot of resolution. In other frames, it might fall just a little short, so that would make it look pointed in some frames and more flat in other frames. And if he would just simply go and take his screen caps of the nose of the airplane in every frame, he would notice that it's just not going to look exactly the same in any two frames. So,
I think that's those are all excellent points. Add whatever you'd like to throw into the mix here, Ace, since we're about to run out of time. But by God, this will be continued, and I'm going to, be in touch with Anthony, and we'll set this up for a couple of weeks hence.
Right. I'm all up for it. Thanks everybody for listening. I know even among those who who understand that 9/11 was an inside job, are still hesitant to accept this notion of media complicity, but we have to be guided by the truth and by a search for the scientific truth, and I would just urge people to open your minds and continue that search.
Ace, superb having you on. Tentatively, I'm going to propose the 11th of October, that's a couple of weeks hence, to have you and Anthony on to do the kind of sequence, 10 minutes alternating as I proposed, and I will find out that Anthony will be agreeable to that, as I suspect he will be, and we'll be able to pursue this all further. I can't thank you enough for coming on. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Go to Ace Baker's site, www.acebaker.com. Click on the asterisk. Ace, thank you so much. Great pleasure.
My pleasure.
Stand by, everybody. This is Jim Fetzer, your host. Thank you all for listening.